doesn't deal with whether or not there was falsity or truth with respect to that statement. He never gets to that particular issue. And that's why his finding and that's why his ruling is an abuse of discretion. But again, I would hearken back to the only evidence before the court that was introduced by both Kaylee, the complaining witness, and by Ms. Henkel, the witness that sought to impeach her, was that it was a false accusation. There was never any claim that it was true. So I think that the argument that the Commonwealth makes that the falsity aspect of the statute or the falsity aspect of Kleinbell hasn't been satisfied isn't accurate when the court looks at what the record is. So therefore, we turn to just traditional impeachment, which we believe the case to be. Witness A makes a statement or denies making a statement. You call witness B to impeach the witness, and the trial court denies your ability to impeach the witness by calling witness B. And I think what's also significant about this particular case is that we also have evidence from the complaining witness, Kaylee, that she had already made a false accusation involving sexual assault. So when you combine her prior admissions that there was a false accusation with the evidence that Ms. Henkel was going to offer about a subsequent false accusation, that's significant, we believe, in what this court should do. The other aspect of the case is harmless error. And I understand that that's a significant argument that the Commonwealth makes. I think what's notable about harmless error is that the defendant was charged with rape, sodomy, abduction. The harmless error argument goes to the finding of the DNA samples in the genital area and is in the underpants. It has nothing to do with the sodomy aspect of it that way. The defendant was acquitted of rape. So obviously the jury had a reasonable doubt about the sufficiency of the Commonwealth's proof and sufficiency of the evidence, despite the finding of the DNA samples in that genital area and in the underwear, and also significantly cast doubt upon the credibility of the witness, Kaylee, based upon her prior accusations. So therefore, we believe that the admission of the subsequent statement by Ms. Henkel would have certainly affected the credibility of Kaylee based upon what the jury did with respect to the counts that were before.
On the harmless error, may I ask you on that? I think I understand your argument on the sodomy, the forcible sodomy, but on the indecent liberties, given the age, wouldn't it be harmless error there? Because regardless of whether, I assume your argument is essentially given the DNA that's found on his genitals and on the underpants, your argument must be that it was consensual.
I didn't try the case, so right. That's not
one. I recognize that, Mr. Broccoletti, but I guess your argument on appeal, I should say, is that it was essentially must be consensual or hasn't been proven. So, I mean, on the indecent liberties, it wouldn't make a difference, would it? Or
well, it could make a difference as to whether or not the entire testimony of the complaining witness was sufficient beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, whether or not the admission of this particular other accusation that was false would be sufficient to cast doubt upon whether the indecent liberties even occurred, whether there was a display of the penis and the touching and the other aspects of the case that went forth with it. So I think that the whole context of the case has to be considered in what the jury did by acquitting him of the rape and by taking all those facts into account.
So well, you have one bit of testimony of the victim here that basically she admits, and it wasn't objected to, where she admits that this guy Panda charged that he raped her and said, no, that wasn't true, I made that up.
Correct.
Would it how much more, it's already been shown that she will not tell the truth, is the additional one about the that seems really sort of bizarre about tied to a tree and three men rape her and then she wakes up in a bed somewhere. Is that, how important is that to the case?
That's an excellent question, and that's why we have a jury. And that's what should have been addressed to the jury, for the jury to make that decision. That's a traditional fact-finding question, for them to weigh all of those factors and her credibility to make that decision. And the absence of that, one, obviously hindered the defendant from furthering that argument, but it also prevented the jury from considering other accusations or other allegations of falsity. So I have a lot of time left, but I'd be glad to answer any other questions or certainly save the balance for the rebuttal.
Further questions, Mr. Brockman?
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Murphy?
Good morning. My name is Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. First, on the rape shield law, and of course, the evidence that's produced here today would be considered excluded by the statute if, in fact, it were a true allegation of sexual conduct. So
but
that
if it's all conceded to be false by everybody testifying.
Well, the accusation wasn't conceded to be false. The defendant, the victim, said she never made it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not unusual in these cases. The next step is we're going to say she made an accusation, and as in Ortiz, they said, well, that accusation was truthful, that you're trying to bring back in. That, so the important thing is, you know, if she said it, was it false? She said she didn't say it. The defendant's going to try to prove that, yes, she did say it. But there's no evidence that if she did say it, it was false. And I think the importance of keeping this kind of evidence out of the jury trial, out of any trial, is that, you know, we don't permit this type of evidence ordinarily. That if it is truly evidence of specific instances of prior sexual conduct, it can come in only after a finding of falsity. And that generally has to be, as the statute says, preceded by a hearing on that issue alone.
How does this get to be something that the rape shield law applies to? It's a question of, basically, did you tell a lie? Now, if she admits she told a lie, as she did for the first instances, then you don't get to bring in the evidence to impeach because you got your answer. And you can argue to the jury that this witness tells lies. But how does that all of a sudden invoke the rape shield law, which is to prevent you from denigrating the victim of a sexual crime by saying you've had all this other sex, therefore you must have done it voluntarily this time? But this question goes to questioning the truthfulness, not the acts that we did or didn't do. And in fact, it's supposed to exclude instances of conduct where the very essence of the question is it was non-conduct. It didn't happen. It couldn't have been conduct. So how do we get the rape shield law into this other than it deals with something that happened in this person's past? This has some sexual connotation or something like it. But how does rape shield get in?
Well, Your Honor, it's a kind of a two-step process. The first thing is that the statute excludes evidence of specific instances of prior sexual conduct. Well, obviously, her statements about prior sexual conduct, if true, would be protected under the rape shield law. That is,
By definition, it's not true. So we don't.
I don't understand why it would, by definition, not be true. Because, you know, she's denied that she made it, but that doesn't mean she admits the falsity of it. I mean, if they have, then the first step for the proponent of the evidence is to demonstrate that, in fact, as in Kleinbell, that it was physically impossible. In Kleinbell, you may remember, she testified that she became pregnant. The evidence they wanted to put in was that she'd become pregnant by other assaults, other family member assaults, at age 10 and 11. And the court said, well, this is inherently impossible. So we don't need a hearing here. We don't have to take evidence on it. This is clearly untrue. It's physically impossible. It's incredible. But I think the difference here is that, you know, this could be true. I mean, Commonwealth has not established it. But I think the major point here is that this is...
If you tell a story that's just almost incredibly fanciful, but it's possible, you know, because now she's old enough, I guess, you know, she could have been raped, you know, and she could have just woken up in a bed somewhere. Just to follow up on Judge Baumgartner's question, it seems that what is they're trying to show here to the jury is a pattern of making false accusations. And one false accusation comes in because it wasn't objected to, essentially. Presumably the Rape Shield statute might have applied to that one under your argument, but it wasn't objected to. This one was, but it is so bizarre in the story that's told. I mean, it doesn't mean this never, ever happened, but it's the way she tells it is so bizarre that her friend doesn't believe it and doesn't, based on her history, doesn't believe what she's telling her about Mr. Poff. So why should a jury not hear that if it's about truthfulness? And then second, if we're looking at harmless error, doesn't this have to be constitutional harmless error given the level of the objection and the ability to confront the right to confront witnesses against you?
Okay, the first part of your question, what I'm saying is that yes, this is something that the judge might very quickly be able to dispose of, but I think the falsity has to be found by the judge with an opportunity for a hearing, which would probably be, you know, just taking the witnesses out of the, removing the jury and having a quick hearing. But something should have been done like that.
Now, what has to be false?
Her allegation that she was raped by these three men.
And so you're saying
you have to prove a negative.
Yes, you basically have to prove that.
How do you prove a negative?
Well, as I pointed out in Kleinbell, they said it was physically impossible. In another case, in an unpublished case, what they determined was that her allegations occurred on a particular date when the defendant was not in the area. So again, that was clearly false. And there would be certain circumstances, and then it would become a credibility issue for the judge when he's looking at it, saying, well, this, I don't think that's true. I think he can make a determination in that way if there is conflicting evidence.
But you're having them to require them to prove something didn't happen, which she said did happen.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the court in Kleinbell said you had to make a finding of falsity, that the court had to do that. I mean, this is not, I didn't make this up. This is, and the question is, in some cases, it may not be necessary.
Who requires, I mean, who has the burden to make sure the court makes that finding of falsity under Kleinbell?
I would suggest that the defendant is the party offering the evidence, and that he should present a record that satisfies the requirements.
So, but there was no one here called the trial court on this issue and said,
no, Your Honor,
you haven't.
Well, the Commonwealth attorney did say in his argument that they were entitled to a hearing and an opportunity to argue this issue before it was brought up in the trial itself. So there was before the court.
Can you answer my question on the constitutional harmless error too?
I'm trying to get there, Your Honor, because that is important. First of all, there's no allegation, no claim of constitutional error in the trial court. And that in and of itself would preclude the defendant now arguing constitutional error.
But isn't it by definition a constitutional error?
No, Your Honor.
It's a right of confrontation.
Well, Your Honor, there was no violation of the right of confrontation. The victim was, in fact, questioned. Evidence was produced on this very fact. And it was then a question of could the other evidence, the other allegation come in? And that is like many evidentiary ruling cases.
So that impeachment testimony essentially,
yes, Your Honor,
would not be...
That would not be constitutional. And probably a good case to look at is Cairns, which is one of our... Cairns, C-A-I. They found error in not admitting the evidence, and then went on and applied harmless error and found harmless error using the non-constitutional standard. And I think, again, that's an excellent demonstration that this kind of evidence is appropriately tried and discussed using that standard. That We have many cases where that issue is raised, but if it's not a full denial of cross-examination, and if that right is not argued in the trial court, this court ordinarily would not get to the issue of constitutional harmless error because it's not before the court. Now, addressing the constitutional error, the court's already pointed out that, first of all, evidence was before the court of this victim's false allegation against, false accusation against a friend or an acquaintance known to her and to the witness, apparently.
You're talking about
With Panda or Michael, yeah. Mm-hmm. And error can, of course, be harmless if the defendant has brought out same or similar evidence on cross-examination. Now, this is, and of course, the one judge denial in this case relied upon that principle in denying the writ. And here it's even more significant because what we have, as the court's already pointed out, a rather fantastic claim of three men having tied her to a tree, raped her, she loses consciousness, wakes up in some strange bed, and of course there's no claim that she ever did anything about that, never reported it to the police, as you might expect in a case like that. Whereas with a friend, you might depend upon the situation. So that it seems to me that what we have here is a substantially less significant piece of impeachment than what the defendant has already obtained from the victim, because this is, of course, what she's alleging is sexual contact by a relative or somebody living in her house, which makes it much more like the Michael or Panda situation. Importantly, even more important here, is that there is uncontestable evidence in the form of DNA of some sexual contact between the defendant and the victim. And I'm not sure why the forcible sodomy, which of course was oral sodomy, is not connected here with that evidence. I mean, in fact, it was her DNA was found on his genital area and in his underwear. And it seems to me that clearly there was sexual contact, which makes this very different from most of the cases where we've had to argue about the false accusations, because there was not convincing physical evidence of what happened.
What's being argued there is that it was consensual, essentially, which you can argue how consensual a 15-year-old with, you know, someone of that age in her own home is, but that there was not, it wasn't the forcible part.
Well, there was no evidence of consent. The defendant did not take the stand and testify that it was consensual. There was no evidence in the record of consensual contact.
Can you address the question I had from Mr. Broccoletti on the indecent liberties? Does it make any difference under harmless error rationale given the age and the relationship of the appellant?
No, it makes no difference at all. Would not be a defense.
Right.
But on the forcible sodomy, I think just as clearly, I mean, certainly there could have been a consensual defense, but there wasn't one. Mm-hmm. And I think that the basic defense was that it didn't happen. That it couldn't have happened because the mother would have heard it because she was in the room just down the hall. So that, yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't this covered by what's now rule, evidence rule 2608E, which says complaining witness in a sexual assault case may be cross-examined by prior false accusations of sexual misconduct? Why doesn't that handle this whole case?
That would handle it if it was a false accusation. And that's how, based on Kleinbell's determination. Under Kleinbell, if it is in fact a false accusation, it is admissible under that. And there's no question about that. If falsity had been demonstrated here, it would be fully admissible. And I might point out that in addition to the DNA evidence, the victim, of course, here immediately left the house, contacted her relatives, and made recent complaints to the police officer and to the SANE nurse. So it seems to me it's not a case where we have no evidence at all other than the victim's own testimony supporting the allegation. I think that as a result...
We know juries can do things that are plenty of case law that are contradictory or not. They don't have to explain it. But the jury must have had some concern about her truthfulness given what happened with regard to the rape and abduction acquittals, right? So on the sodomy and indecent liberties, especially on the sodomy, forcible sodomy, why wouldn't it have been pretty important? How do we know what the jury would have done on guilt or sentence?
Well, you know, I mean,
that this
what we always do in these cases is you look at the evidence and see whether, first of all, was there other substantial convincing evidence of his guilt? And we have clear evidence that he was engaged in sexual contact with her. That's indisputable. Mm-hmm. We also know that...
So you don't think Zechtal here would apply in this case?
Excuse me?
You don't think the Supreme Court's decision in Zechtal would apply here?
I'm not familiar with that immediately, Your Honor, at this point.
Basically talked about you questions of not only guilt but sentencing. You have to prove that it would not have affected, if you're looking at a harmless error analysis, that it would not have affected either.
I don't see why this would have affected sentencing. I mean, if they had... the fact is all it would have done was indicate, well, she has lied before, she lied again. I don't think it would have, and as I say, in an obviously fantastic fashion, would have made any difference either to the outcome of the trial or to the sentence. And for those reasons, I request that the decision be made. Well, unless there are any further questions from the court.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Broccoletti, you have your rebuttal time, and
yes, sir.
I gave him a little extra time, so I'm happy to give you
that. I'm sure I'm not going to take that much. But it's interesting, trying to Bumgarner, I wrote, prove a negative before you said it. That's exactly the point that we're trying to raise. How do you possibly prove the falsity of a statement when the witness denies making the statement? What's the... Maybe, I don't know, I miss it, but how do you prove the falsity of that statement? She says, I never made that statement. But then you do have a witness that comes in, Ms. Henkel, that says it was false. She said, I was joking. So the only evidence before the trial court was that it was a false statement.
How do you deal with Mr. Murphy's point that Clonbell and some of its progeny seems to require the trial court to make a finding, an initial finding of falsity, and that didn't occur here?
Well, I think... Because there was evidence before the court that the statement was false. I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but there was the only evidence before the court that is that it was false. And so if the court were confronted with the issue, and if Judge Fulton was asked, is this a false statement or not a false statement, the only evidence that he had to rely upon was the evidence of Ms. Henkel, who testified that Kaylee told her it was a joke. And then he has Kaylee, who denies ever making the statement to begin with. So even if the court did not make that ruling, the court was not asked by either side to make that ruling, the judge should have made that ruling. I think it's incumbent upon the trial court. There's plenty of case law to the effect that the trial court's required to follow the law as the court knows it. But the only evidence before him to have made that ruling, if the question were posed to him, was that it was false. So I think what we're talking about is an issue that really isn't an issue. If you had conflicting testimony about whether it was true or false, and he had to make a credibility question, then I can understand the argument.
So you're saying rape shield statute shouldn't apply, so there's no reason he needed to have an initial finding of falsity because this was just pure impeachment.
Correct. Well, that, and even if you wanted to go one step farther and say the rape shield statute should apply and he should make some finding, the only finding that he could have made was that it was false.
Unless, as Mr. Murphy said, she wasn't saying it was false. She was just saying, I never said that to her.
Well, that should take it out of the rape shield statute altogether, as the court's already indicated. That's not even conduct now that we're talking about. what the court had already said, the statute was designed to prevent the denigration, I think the court's words were, the denigration of a character of an individual based upon prior conduct. Well, she denies that it occurred altogether. That's what I'm saying. How do you prove the falsity of that statement when she denies making the statement at all?
Can you address the constitutional versus non-constitutional harmless error and
yes.
the Supreme Court's decision in Zechtal?
I think that you have an equation here. You have 2 plus 2 equals 4, and that's how you get to the issue of whether or not the witness's credibility has been established beyond a reasonable doubt. We have the first part. We have the 2, where she denies making the statement, but we don't have the second part, the other 2, where the witness comes in and says, she did make that statement to me. So I think that in order from the confrontation aspect of the case, yes, we were able to confront her with the aspect of making that statement, but we weren't able to complete the circle by bringing in the evidence of the impeachment that she did in fact make that statement for the jury to therefore make the credibility decision that the court had talked to. Now, and also with respect to the sentencing argument, he was sentenced to 13 years under the sodomy, 6 months on the indecent liberties. Obviously, that pattern of lies that she had told, again, as the court had indicated, which I think is a very good analogy that we were unable to present to the jury, that there was a pattern of falsehoods, that there was this ability of her to concoct and make up a story to be able to present to people. That should have been presented. That could have affected the sentencing aspect as well. I'd be glad to answer any questions that the court may have.
Are you familiar with Zechtal?
Not much.
No, that's all right.
I'll concede that.
All right.
Okay.
Any further questions for Mr. Broccoletti?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Broccoletti. We will re-counsel, and then the next case on our docket is Chelsea and Nicole Costin versus Commonwealth.